From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For a lot of us, it's when we go camping that we get a sense of the night sky. You figure since you're away from the city, it's dark. Well, not really. It's really hard to find real darkness. Some say you can't. Not anymore. But the writer Paul Bogard went looking anyway to see if there are any places left with natural darkness in the lower 48 states. Bogard has written a book about that search. He wanted to learn how night has changed and what it means that most young people will grow up never finding a spot dark enough to encounter the Milky Way. Along the way, he also learned about the health effects of all of this artificial light and the efforts to conserve the dark. Bogard will join us today. His book is called The End of Night, after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Many of us have gotten away from the lights of the city far enough to look up at night and see a multitude of stars. But the truth is, no matter how beautiful or inspiring, there is some light seeping into that experience usually. It's what the writer Paul Bogard calls the collected glow from streetlights, parking lots, gas stations, sports stadiums, buildings, shopping centers, and houses, of course. In his book, The End of Night, Bogard writes about finding a spot in the United States in the Eureka Valley of California that was about as dark as it gets in the 21st century. And he says the sky felt ancient, describes being disoriented by the experience, in fact. Bogard went looking for places in the lower 48 states that hadn't been tarnished by artificial light. And along the way, he chronicled how night has changed and what that means, and what some people are trying to do about it, about all of this artificial light in our lives, most of which Bogard says is not comforting or useful, but waste. The book is called The End of Night, and we're talking about it today. Paul Bogard is a writer and a professor of creative nonfiction at James Madison University in Virginia. He's also the editor of an anthology called Let There Be Light, Testimony on Behalf of the Dark. Paul Bogard, welcome. Thanks for being with
us. Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, I want to begin with the Wendell Berry quote. I mean, you use this terrific quote as an epigraph for the book. And Berry talks about how to know the dark, you have to go dark. What does he mean by go dark? Because I guess that idea really resonated with you when you read it.
It does. I love that. It's a short poem by Berry, and it's just that idea that to know the dark, we have to be willing to walk out into it, to embrace it, that when we take our light with us, our artificial lights, that we cut off the darkness from us. So a real good example of that is walking at night with a flashlight, mm-hmm. and we think that helps show us the way that we're going. And it does, but it also cuts off our vision of everything around us. So in that narrowness of the light on the path ahead of us, we're losing everything else around us.
You, growing up, you had this cabin with your family in northern Minnesota. Still have it. In fact, it's still in the family. And you write about how, or you've talked about anyway, how this was your first experience really with what you call real darkness. We'll get to defining our terms, what that means, real darkness, in a minute. But now you say that young people growing up, really, many may not have an experience like that. Talk about what it was like for you, because this was your first experience, and what you mean by real darkness. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I was so lucky. I grew up in Minneapolis, and the year I was born, my parents and grandparents built this cabin about 3 hours north in the lake country of northern Minnesota. And so every summer of my life, and oftentimes over Christmas and New Year's, we would head up there for weeks at a time. And I had this firsthand experience of real night. And so in the summer, we would walk out onto the dock. stand at the edge of the dock and just watch the Milky Way bending from horizon to horizon. Mm-hmm. And I still can see the slow straight lines of satellites moving through sugary spreads of stars, just, you know, stars that so many stars, it just looked like somebody had spilled a box of sugar mm-hmm. on the sky, that kind of imagery. And that has changed. That has changed from, that was some 35, 40 years ago now. And it's still dark up there, but because of the light pollution in the towns around the area, the sky that I knew as a child has faded. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, I guess I would just say that, you know, a lot of my book is about this firsthand experience of real night and real darkness. And what I'm hoping to raise people's awareness of is that, many of us had this, if we were a certain age, and it seems like it's people older than 40 in their 50s, 60s, and beyond who have had this firsthand experience of coming face to face with the universe, and people younger than that have never had that experience. Mm.
What's the difference? I love this moment in the book where you take to Manhattan in the Museum of Modern Art to see, as you say, some real darkness. And this, of course, is in Van Gogh's painting Starry Night. And you say you love the story that the painting tells, which you describe as not this, you know, crazy image of a crazy man, but this is how you put it in the book. A small, dark town, a few gas lights and house windows under a brilliant sky. And it's one of those paintings that you can encounter before light began to obscure the sky. And I wanted to ask you about that painting. There's another painting you went to see there, which we'll talk about. But Starry Night, which was so interesting about it, is you talk about how Van Gogh had written a letter about looking up at the night when he was walking on a beach in France somewhere. And the thing that is so striking is he talks about seeing color in that sky. And you say there is color. If we can find an actual dark sky, and if we let our eyes adjust, if we're patient, that it's not just white stars up there. There's a lot of color. So I guess that gets at, for me anyway, what the difference might be. The difference for those of us who go camping, you know, and are still, they think the stars look great. But there's a difference when you're in real darkness and you're encountering a real sky or what you call an ancient sky. It's different in many ways. We talk about the difference, I guess.
Yeah, I love that the painting that you talk about, The Starry Night by Van Gogh, and that's a really great example of the difference that you're talking about. The story that I love about that is that he was painting at a time when our experience of night was different. I describe it as old night. Yeah. He was able to see, as you can, when you are in a truly dark place and your eyes have adjusted to the darkness, the color, the different colors of the stars, and so many other things as well. We forget, or maybe we never learn, that the human eye is this incredible organ that is capable of seeing so much more than we ask it to. We just need to give it time out in the darkness, and it will reveal these wonders to us. And I look at the Starry Night, the Van Gogh painting, and I remember the Joachim Pissarro, who's the great grandson of the famous French painter, and who had worked with the Van Gogh exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art. He said, you know, most people think that Van Gogh was just sort of this crazy man, this werewolf of energy, you know. Yeah. And that's what we're seeing on the painting. That's the only reason the stars are so bright, and the moon is throbbing, and the sky is swirling. You know, it's just the reflection of somebody who's insane or nearly so. And you know, Van Gogh was obviously an artist, maybe a genius, certainly creative, but he was also being inspired by a night sky that we just don't get to be inspired by now. And I sometimes think, you know, how many young Van Goghs are out there all around the world who are missing out on this experience and therefore not producing the kind of art that might make us, that might wow us in the way that, you know, this painting does.
You went to see another painting there as well, one that captured kind of the new version of night, Giacomo Balla's Street Light. Talk about the difference in those two.
Yeah, you know, first I was struck by the fact that whereas the Starry Night, Van Gogh's painting, is on display every day of the year and, you know, some 50 million people come by it, this other painting by Balla is, at least on the day I was there, wasn't even on display. I think it's one of those paintings that they rotate in and out. Mm-hmm. And it's about three times the size of a Starry Night, and it's the painting of a streetlight. And we think, a painting of a streetlight, why would you know, what's so special about that? But this was at the turn of the century, of the 20th century, when street lighting was, electric street lighting was just beginning to emerge, to, you know, eventually would spread and sort of take over our nights. But at this point, Balla was fascinated by it, and he saw the great potential for it, even the beauty of an electric streetlight. And you see that in this painting. I mean, it's just full of color and just, you know, kind of radiating energy and color outward. And I couldn't help but be impressed by it. I mean, it really, you look at it and you think, wow, that is beautiful. You know, it's just that, as the woman who was showing me the painting said, she's a native New Yorker, and she said, New York is never dark enough to see this. You know, we never see electric light like this, in this way. So yeah, back to back, those two paintings really, reveal kind of the old night of Van Gogh. And then, as I say, the night from now on of this electric light.
Yeah. Do you think that Balla painting in some ways reflects our conflicted sense of light? I mean, on one hand, like, I remember being a kid going to the Timpanogos Cave here in Utah. And there's this moment in the tour, I'm not sure if they still do it, it was kind of the novelty moment where they shut out all the lights. I mean, you're deep inside the cave and they shut off all the lights. And you get the sense of just how dense darkness can really be. And I remember being really terrified by the idea of darkness. And I'm wondering if there's something in our, you know, in our genes, you know, that we've always been afraid of dark. And so in some ways, light is comforting. And so we feel conflicted about light and darkness. Do you find that?
Absolutely. I think I saw that again and again in a lot of different ways. And I'm always, I guess, quick and to say, make the point that, you know, what I'm saying is not that light is bad. I think that artificial light, primarily electric light at this point, though we are beginning to move into electronic lighting, which is something that we could talk more about. But electric light is a miracle. It's a wonder. It really has, you know, changed human life in so many valuable ways. And so it's not that light is bad. I want to get away from thinking that, you know, light is bad and darkness is good, that I want everything dark. That's not at all what I'm saying. I'm just saying that, you know, we're using far more light than we need to, and we're using it irresponsibly. So I spent a lot of time thinking about and writing about and talking to people about how we can use light more intelligently. And, you know, one of the great experiences I had was to spend time in Paris, the city of light, and to spend time with the man who has spent the last 30 years redesigning all the light in Paris. Mm-hmm. And just the time and the thought and the effort that has gone into lighting, especially the old part of Paris, to create this beautiful atmosphere that we all know and appreciate and love. And you compare that to a lot of the cities in the rest of the world, certainly in the U.S., where light at night just sort of means blasting a floodlight against a building. You know, we can do a lot better than that. And I think that's kind of the focus. Let's use light in better ways, more intelligently.
The premise for the book is you kind of set out to see if you can find in the lower 48 states. I mean, you could have gone anywhere, of course, but you focused on the U.S., the lower, lower 48, as you say. And the idea is you're seeing if you can find true natural darkness. What is it that you were trying to get at, because it wasn't just a gimmick to find dark places. The idea was to find out and explore, in some ways, I suppose, our relationship with night, how night has changed. And we'll get into health and all those other kinds of things as we go. Mm-hmm. But what was the essential concept that you were going for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the first things, and I talk about this in the introduction, one of the first things that I wanted to make clear is that, you know, I'm not on a journey to the most exotic locations in the world, you know, where I can find darkness. I'd be happy to take those journeys, but that's not really what I was after. What I was after is, what is our experience of night in the places where most of us live, that is most Americans and most Western Europeans especially. And so I wanted to talk about the darkness that's in our daily lives and our nights. And that includes the quote-unquote darkness in places like Las Vegas and Times Square, where I begin. But it also includes the darkness that we still have in places that I get to at the end of the book, like Bryce Canyon and the Grand Canyon and Death Valley, and those places that are already really special to us, that we already really love. And I wanted to draw our attention and say, you know, this is darkness that's accessible. You know, you don't have to get on a plane, as somebody suggested I do at the start of the book, and fly to Australia and drive out into the middle of the desert. I just, you know, I thought I'm happy to do that, but I just don't think, you know, a lot of us are going to have that chance. But we do have the chance, most of us, to, you know, you can, one of the places I talk about is Natural Bridges National Monument. And I write about how, you know, you can drive out to the spot that I went to, park, use the outhouse, you know, whatever you want, and walk out and experience this amazing night. It is accessible to us.
Yeah. You go to the Great Basin National Park as well to sort of see for yourself, as you put it, what's left of the dark. Mm-hmm. Eastern Nevada, you mentioned that the desert there, some of the darkest geography really left in the United States. And I want to have you read a section. This comes early in the book. It's when you are going to the Great Basin, and it's early in the evening, that time of day when, as you write about, it's that the direction of the energy glow is kind of reversing from all of that gathering heat to the temperatures now dropping, and it's twilight. That long blue moment is what the biologist Robin Wall Kimmerer called it, which is a lovely reference. Read this section, if you would.
Sure. We like to think that darkness falls, as though it were like snow. But as the earth turns its back to the sun, darkness actually rises from the east to wash and flood over land and sea. If you've ever stood at dusk and seen a gloaming on the eastern horizon, as though clouds were gathering, a thunderstorm brewing, that's what you're seeing, the earth's shadow as we rotate into it. What we call night is the time when we're caught in that shadow. A shadow that extends into space like the cone to Earth's ice cream, 100 times taller than its wide, its vertex 860,000 miles above the Earth. Dawn comes as we rotate out of that shadow into the edges of direct sunlight. Driving northeast away from what's left of this light, I look to the darkening sky and wonder what will be revealed. Venus, the evening star, emerges in the driver's side window just over a silhouetted range, and then the first few actual stars, those of the Big Dipper, maybe the most well-known pattern of stars in the history of the world. One of those stars, Mizar, the second from the end of the Dipper's handle, is actually a double star, a visual binary, confirmed by telescope in 1650, but known to stargazers for millennia. In fact, the ability to see Mizar's faint twin, Alcor, with the naked eye has long been a traditional test of vision, one I admit I'm failing as the first bright town appears down the road. The name of the town doesn't matter, for at least when it comes to light pollution, this town is the same as 10,000 others. While its lights contribute only a little to the pollution blanketing the nation, all the different threads of the problem are here. The lights are all unshielded, for one thing, and so glare shoots this way and that, cast into the dark with little reason. Wood and chain-link fences mark the boundaries between neighbors, but each neighbor's lights here, as all across America, are allowed to roam far beyond their boundaries, a perfect example of what dark sky advocates call light trespass. The lights from these unshielded fixtures not only trespass onto the yards of neighbors and into the eyes of drivers passing through, but straight into the sky, their energy wasted. The solitary gas station is lit beyond daylight, that light too floating from under the gas pump canopy to wipe away stars over the town. Drop-lens cobra-head streetlights are strung down every street, glaring into bedroom and living rooms, the surrounding desert, and up toward the stars. Toward the edge of the town come a smattering of security lights, those ubiquitous white lamps hovering over backyards, barnyards, and driveways across the country, and then one final billboard lit from below, the upward-pointing light skipping from the ad into space without pause. When the town ends, the darkness at its edge envelops the car, and my headlights cut the lit world down to just what lies ahead. The land on either side falls away, as though the highway is a bridge with 1,000-foot drops to the left and to the right. The windshield soon resembles a Van Gogh night sky with its starry smattering of bugs. A jackrabbit sits eating at the side of the road, lifting its long ears absently as the car rushes past. Not long after, a coyote steps from the highway's other side, eyes aglow, a less fortunate jack hanging from its jaws. A barn owl lifts from the highway marker on the shoulder and flaps ahead for a few beats as though leading the way, then veers off into darkness and disappears.
It's Paul Bogard. The name of his book is The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Paul Bogard. We're talking about his book, The End of Night. Two-thirds of us here in the United States no longer experience real darkness. And today in the program, we're talking about what that means. In his book, he went looking to see if he could find a place that had natural darkness. He's talking about what he found out about darkness, about the effects of artificial light on human energy and sleep patterns and health and ecology as well. Well, explain what you mean by real darkness. There was one man, a guy by the name of John Bortle, created an actual scale for us. So we do have some sense of it. Talk about the scale, the variations in darkness, I guess.
Sure. This is the Bortle scale, as we know it, is about a dozen years old, created by John Bortle, this amateur astronomer from upstate New York who was being invited out by mostly younger astronomers to places that they said, it's so dark out here, you have to come see what we're seeing. And time and again, he had the experience of heading out to meet them and realizing that it really wasn't all that dark. And it slowly dawned on him that these younger amateur astronomers had never really understand what real darkness was. And just because they probably had never really experienced it. And so he came up with a scale of darkness that begins with 9 and works its way down to 1. And so 9 being our brightest places, places like a Las Vegas or a Times Square or really any the center urban area of any city in the world at this point, and works his way down to 1, which represented this primordial darkness, these places where there's no evidence of artificial light. A couple of things that stand out to me about this scale is that most Americans live most of our lives in the levels 5 and above. And so, you know, if you ask people, does it get dark at night, they might look at you and say, well, yeah, of course. But really, where most of us live, it doesn't get dark, at least not the way that it used to. And so he wanted to raise our awareness of that and to help us understand that the darkness that we know is really not the darkness that used to exist, that people used to experience all the time.
We should say that the book kind of works its way through the scale, 9 to 1, 9 being Vegas.
It does. I stumbled upon that idea to start with chapter 9 and work my way down to chapter 1, which gave me a neat rubric for the journey that I would take. So starting in these bright places and generally working my way down to these really dark places.
I guess it's surprising that Vegas has the Strip, of course, which I guess is one of the brightest, if not the brightest spots in the world. But you also point out it's not just the Strip that makes it bright. It's this sense that, like most cities and suburbs, there's this kind of accumulated growth. And that's one of the things I was interested in the book, is that it's this accumulation of light that you get at in terms of the sense of waste as well.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. The first night I went to Las Vegas, I met the head of the Las Vegas Astronomical Society, which kind of in and of itself seems like an oxymoron, but like, how does that really exist? But it does. And yeah, he was kind enough to meet me on the Strip, and we were looking for the stars down there. And he told me a really interesting story that the previous March, during the Earth Hour, the hour that the World Wildlife Fund has, the idea that we turn off our lights for an hour as a way to raise our awareness about energy use, they had successfully gotten the casinos along the Strip, the casinos and the hotels, to turn their lights off for that hour. And so you would kind of think that, boy, if the casinos and the hotels on the Las Vegas Strip turn off their lights, it's going to be suddenly really dark in Vegas, because those are so bright. But what he told me is that, and he was on a highway kind of at the outskirts of town and was able to look down into the city. And he said that when that happened, when they turned off these brilliantly lit hotels and casinos on the Strip in Vegas, it really didn't make that much difference to the lighting level of Las Vegas. And the reason why is because Las Vegas has the same recipe of accumulated light that every other city in the U.S. and around the world has, which is to say, parking lots and gas stations and street lights and stadium lighting and, you know, on down the line. And they hadn't done anything about those lights during the Earth Hour. So yeah. Kind of wherever you go, you find this mix of light that all together creates what we know of as light pollution.
Let's take a few calls. Crystal is with us in Salt Lake City. Crystal, hi.
Hi. My husband and daughter are members of the Walker River Paiute Tribe in Shores, Nevada. They're very connected to the sky, and one of the most popular songs to sing at the powwow and dance at the dance is the Milky Way song. And I was just wondering if you've explored any current Native American traditions in the West that had to do with the sky.
Mm. Yeah, and did they give you any insights about, you know, the, as you call it, the ancient sky and older sky?
Yeah, it's a great question, and you could write an entire book about that. In fact, people have. There are good books out there just on the Native American traditions as related to the constellations, especially in the night sky. But I did talk a little bit with a couple different Native Americans, including Joseph Bruchak, mm-hmm. who told me so much about the Native view, especially of, I thought this was really interesting, of light and darkness. So not just artificial light and darkness of the night, but also we were talking about metaphorical light and dark. And he said, you know, whereas the sort of the dominant Western society sees light as good and darkness as bad, that kind of strict dichotomy, the Native traditions actually see those things much more mingled. And that, you know, very rarely is something all good or all bad, you know, that there's elements of both those qualities in every living thing. And mm-hmm. so, boy, it just seemed like you know, such a richer approach to the subject of light and darkness and night.
Crystal, thanks. Curtis is with us in Bountiful, Utah. Curtis, welcome.
Hi. This is kind of an interesting subject. I just wanted to point out that there probably is no absolute darkness in the entire universe. Even if you were to go into a cave, there's natural radiation in all the matter of the Earth that's given off light of various wavelengths. And in the universe, there's the background radiation and light from the galaxies that fill the entire universe. And even if you go down into caves, also you've got neutrinos from the sun that anytime they impact, those neutrinos go all the way through the Earth, but anytime they do impact matter, they emit a little bit of light. But you're never going to have absolute darkness. I just wanted to, state that.
Yeah, well, it's a good point, I guess, but Paul Bogard, I guess you don't really care about that. I mean, sure, but you're not talking about that. Doesn't seem
I'm
anyway.
I'm not really. I love hearing, you know, what the caller has to say just because I think it's fascinating and really interesting. But no, you know, I'm not interested in absolutes either way. And I guess one thing, though, I would say, and this relates to what the caller is saying, is that in order to see natural light, so the beautiful natural light that we might be talking about, like the Milky Way or what astronomers call air glow, or, you know, just simple things like a shooting star, you have to get out into darkness. And it's only when you get into dark places that you actually see this natural light. So it in many places, it's the darker you get, the more light you see, but it's the more natural light, which is really the wonderful thing.
Yeah. It's not as, it's funny, it's ironic in some way. It's not necessarily about dark. It's about light. Natural.
It is. Absolutely. And it's funny, people say, well, what book are you writing next? And I said, well, my first idea was to write about light. You know, I've kind of written about darkness, now I'll write about light. It's fascinating. I've learned a lot about it. It's a topic that, you know, I'd like to have us be talking about. And when I approached my editor, he said, well, you've kind of been writing about that already, yeah. You know, and I think you're right. This is as much a book about light as it is about darkness.
It's interesting, Bob Berman, the book is full of these characters, the physicians and writers and activists and scientists and their stories related to light. I'll pick out a few as we go, but Bob Berman is one, a writer who talks about, I loved this, he said that an observer really needs to see 450 stars at a time to get that feeling of infinitude, you know, to be swept away. So everyone has their own kind of scale. But for Berman, he's saying that there's an actual number of stars that you've got to be able to see if you're going to be able to kind of get in the zone almost. It seems to be what he's talking about.
He does. And I think we love those kinds of, you know, markers to be able to say, you know, 450 stars equals X kind of thing. And the thing I took away from what Bob was saying is that if you think about the fact that the human eye on a clear, naturally dark night, a good viewing night, you're out for a while, the human eye is capable of seeing more like 2,500 to 3,000 stars. And then you go to our cities and most of the places we live, that number is more not 2,500, but in some cases 25 or fewer, or, you know, 40 or that kind of thing. It's nowhere near what our eyes are capable of seeing. Nor is it even near this 450 number that Bob uses, where kind of the threshold you have to get in terms of having that moment where you step outside and you think, oh my gosh, this is just amazing. Most of us, again, don't live in places where we even come close to that 450 number. Mm.
Curtis, thanks. Back to the phones. Pete is with us in Ogden. Pete, welcome.
Well, I just want to, what a fascinating subject. You know, I work for the railroad. I work a lot of nights and take trains across Wyoming. And just in the last 10 or 15 years, it's changed dramatically. You know, and some of it's for a great reason. You know, a lot of windmills up there now, a lot of wind power. But it used to be so much darker, a lot of gas plants. You can still see the Milky Way. You can still see thousands of stars, but it's getting lighter every year. And it's something that, you know, nobody takes into account, but it's one of those things that when it's, I guess it's not like wilderness. You can get it back, but it's a different experience now.
Well, I guess the question is, can you get it back? But let me go to his point. Paul Bogard, you talk about this change, how being gradual. You mentioned that if we could jump from the dark of decades ago all the way today, you'd notice the difference. But because it's been so gradual, it's harder to tell.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the statistics that I come back to again and again is the way that gas stations and parking lots, which are two of the sort of prime contributors to light pollution, are now lit 10 times more brightly than they were lit on average about 20 years ago. So, you know, for most of us, 20 years ago doesn't seem like that all that long ago. We remember 20 years ago. And then to think, gosh, the gas stations parking lots that are part of our night tonight are 10 times as bright as they were just 20 years ago. It's kind of mind-boggling. And it's a change that is happening very rapidly in some senses, but just slowly enough that we don't really notice. Mm.
I think Pete's question is a good one. And the last part of that is, I guess we can get it back, he says. But do you think that's right? Can you really get that back?
Sure. I mean, it's a wonderful question. It's a complex question with lots of different, you know, where exactly are we talking about? But one thing that we can do make huge progress in bringing it back simply by shielding our lights. You know, so many of our lights in our cities, towns, even out in the rural areas are unshielded. And so light is just spraying all over the place. Simply by shielding those lights, I'm not even talking about turning off the lights. I'm just saying shield the light so it, instead of, you know, lighting up the surrounding area in all directions, you're just lighting what you want lit, your property, your house, your street. We could make huge progress. And one other point I guess I'd make is that people sometimes say to me, oh, you know, the cities are so bright, you know, you'll never make any progress on this. And I say, you know, we're not talking about making the cities black or dark. We're talking about shielding the lights, having a lower level of lighting. And sure, the cities will still be lit, but the wonderful thing that could happen if you lower the lights in the cities, if you shield those lights, there'll be a rippling effect out into the suburbs, into the rural areas, where those places, the skies there, the experience of real night can come back there. And I think that's really a moving and I found really motivating thing to think about, that this is an issue that we can do something about.
Pete, thanks. Let's go back to the phone. Sarah is with us in Preston, Idaho. Sarah, hi.
I love the program. It's an intriguing subject. And I think the author has answered the question about what can be done to save what I consider sacred spaces. I would add, I have visited a ranch some years ago very near the Great Basin National Park of which he speaks. Mm. It's an area called Spring Valley, Nevada. And though I was raised in the upper Midwest, I had never seen stars in that magnitude and of that brilliance of what it was like late night, early morning in that area. Mm. So I know of what you speak. And I'm glad there is a possibility of what you call shielding.
Yeah. Well, Eastern Nevada, that's a special place, right, Paul Bogard?
Absolutely. And yeah, it's I was lucky enough to live in the West for 12 years, first in Albuquerque and then in Reno, and got to travel around to a lot of different places, including in Utah. And now I live out east. And I have to tell you that, you know, anybody living in Salt Lake or the surrounding areas, you're so lucky because there are places that you can go and have experience of real darkness, even though it's under threat. We need to take action now to preserve it. You have that chance, and so many Americans just don't have.
When did this effort to preserve or conserve or protect this darkness begin? I mean, you talk to a number of these activists. Chad Moore is a terrific character. Dan Durisco is a terrific character. And I have to say, Utah's sort of plays an important role in all of this.
It really does. And the two men that you talk about, Chad and Dan, are part of the National Park Service's night sky team.
Right.
Just within the last decade, the National Park Service has recognized that darkness, along with other resources, is something that they want to preserve. They see it as part of their mission. And so Chad and Dan were instrumental in creating the Park Service night sky team, which means they've gone all over the National Park Service measuring levels of darkness as a way to say, this is where we are. This is what we need to preserve. And it really has been just very recently within the last, say, decade or two that both in the States and around the world have we really started to recognize and realize that this is a problem with serious costs, you know, human health, ecological health, safety, monetary costs. And it's also something that we can do something about, but we need to become aware of it now and start to take action.
Mm. It's interesting. There are a number of, in some of these national parks, you have these people who will take you on these night, what do they call them, night tours?
Yeah, they vary from place to place, night full moon walks in Bryce Canyon, that kind of thing, sure.
And the idea is to get people, it seems like this theme comes up in the book a lot. We'll get to this after a break, but this idea of one particular sleep doctor talking about getting patients comfortable with being in the dark, it seems like that's the same thing going on in some of these national parks. People saying, you know, let your eyes adjust, let your kind of consciousness adjust to the dark. Don't be afraid of it. Get used to it, I suppose.
Exactly. I think that's a theme running throughout the book, that we've become afraid of the dark and we've let that fear kind of overrule our thinking about the dark rather than be comfortable with it.
Paul Bogard is with us. The name of his book is The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer Paul Bogard. We're talking about his book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Another thing that you write about in the book, of course, is the sort of health effects of not having enough darkness, I suppose, in our lives. You write about how epidemiologists have, you know, who first connected light and night with increased rates of cancer, for example. There's a section on sleep. You mentioned we need sleep like we need food and water. Talk about another character in the book, Dr. Vaughn McCall. He's the head of the Sleep Center at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center in North Carolina. He talks about how artificial light is affecting our health, our weight, our sex lives even. Talk about that.
Sure. I think another character called sleep disorders the number one health epidemic in the country right now, something like that. Yet another researcher said that our sleep disorders are tied to every major disease that we're dealing with now. And he said that he thinks our understanding of this, of our need for sleep and the costs of artificial light at night and how it's impacting our sleep, is kind of where our understanding of smoking and our health was in the 1950s. So we're beginning to see the effects of this, but we haven't quite figured it all out. And Dr. McCall works a lot with insomniacs. And I remember, you know, the thing that he told me that stands out to me is just one of the first steps that he takes with his patients is just to help them become comfortable when they wake up at night in the dark. He has, you know, so many patients who, when they wake up in the night, they start to panic, they get anxious. And he said he just wants them to be comfortable with the dark. And we can extrapolate that idea out to all of us in a sense. You know, are we comfortable with the dark? Are we comfortable being out in natural darkness? And unfortunately, too often the answer is no. And we tend to avoid it or ignore it or try to do away with it with our lights.
There's a section also where you write about, there's a man named Reuben Neiman, wrote this book called Healing Night about the science of sleep. And what's interesting about what Neiman writes about is the effect of light on what he calls our night consciousness. He talks about this idea of having a relationship with the night. What does he mean by that?
I think he means kind of the same thing that Dave Crawford, who founded the International Dark Sky Association, meant when he talked about a night consciousness. Just this, I mean, it almost sounds funny or strange, but just this idea that we're not even aware that night exists, you know, that, and these folks want us to become aware of how important night and its accompanying darkness is for, for life on Earth, all life on Earth that evolved in bright days and dark nights, as did humans. It's just, it's an important, beyond important to us. We need darkness for optimal health, and that's physical health, mental health, even spiritual health. We need that darkness.
Mm. You also write about the ecology of darkness. You say in the book, every living creature suffers from the loss of light. Say something about that, if you would, the impact that all of this natural light is having on the natural world.
Sure. It's tremendous. And again, this idea that every living creature, every species has evolved with bright days and dark nights. And so there are innumerable nocturnal species, but also even more crepuscular species, those species that are active at dusk and dawn. And for those creatures that have evolved to depend on darkness, our bright lights are as destructive to them as in the daytime a bulldozer would be plowing through their habitat. It's, you know, if you imagine a moth, for example, and people don't even understand how important moths are in the ecology and the food chain and for us in terms of pollination, but this moth has evolved into darkness and all of a sudden its habitat is flooded with light, and too often for no reason, just light allowed to spray into the woods, into the forest, into the desert for no reason. That moth has essentially lost its home. It won't be able to live. And the costs for the moth are obvious, but even for us are serious.
Mm. We talked about Dan Durisco. He's one of the founding members of this night sky team with the National Park Service. And he talks about how it's like you have to adjust your eyes, you know, kind of acclimate them to this unique experience. Dark adapted is how you put it. Mm. And you write about going with Durisco to the Death Valley National Park. This is towards the end of the book. And you drop into the Eureka Valley. Mm. I want to have you read this section. You describe how when you were there, the sky felt ancient. Mm. Read this for us.
Sure. Primitive darkness. The desert before civilization, before settlement. The dark land with no light of its own and stars coming all the way to the ground. The Big Dipper setting, revolving into the northern horizon. Orion rising from the southeast with Betelgeuse flashing its red-orange cape in the atmosphere. The zodiacal band, like a fainter Milky Way, twirls skyward from the western horizon. The valley so dark you see by night's natural light, the zodiacal light and air glow, and maybe 10% from the stars. Durisco and I see each other faintly. With no trees or woods, we see in all directions to where mountains saw jagged horizons from the bottom of the sky. That sky becomes brighter and darker the longer we stay out, in a way almost no one in America experiences now. Our eyes go dark adapted, good at 10 minutes, even more at 45. But then after 2 hours of wide open eyes in the land with no lights, the sky shifts into focus like an optometrist switching a lens and saying, "Better?" Before this, there were stars, but now there are stars upon stars and a sense of stars you can't yet see. In the city, you'll never see it like this, Durisco says. Even out here, it takes patience, and we expect instant results. People drive out from Las Vegas because they hear there's a star party and say, "Now show me the night sky. I got about 5 minutes." We climb from Eureka and drop onto winding washboard toward Crankshaft Junction. "These are the last of the wild roads," Durisco says, "and we're in the blackest part of the map." We're within a few miles of the Nevada border, the Los Angeles light dome blocked now by the mountains, but not the faint dome from Las Vegas some 160 miles southeast. I've been at the center of that, and now I'm at the center of this, from the brightest spot on the map to one of the darkest. This dark land, the way I no longer expect to see any lights, the way the dark feels both comfortable and comforting as the night goes on. Lots of amateur astronomers don't care, as long as they can see the sky, Durisco explains, but to me, it's the land and the sky together that makes this experience unique in the West. The wild land and the wild sky.
You write about also going to Maine, the Acadia National Park there, to see the nighttime sky. And you see these rangers we were talking about who do these nighttime walks. And you say that that place and other places, I guess, like this, give you a sense of hope. So let me ask you that finally. You talk about how the National Park Service is really dealing with these issues of conserving darkness. And it's an opportunity for parks to reach more people. Do you feel hopeful about it all?
I do actually feel hopeful. I'm not naive about it. I understand it's a big problem. But compared to some of the other problems we're dealing with, light pollution is one that is readily something that we can handle. I would say that one of the reasons I feel hopeful is that I think that as people become more aware of all the light around us and about how important darkness is, they'll start to realize that the way we're using light now is counterproductive to us. It's wiping out the stars. It's having ecological impacts. It's harming us physically, mentally, and spiritually. And it's not making us any safer. You know, a bright light that's shining, glaring into your eye is not making you safer. So interestingly, what will solve some of this, shielding the lights like we were talking about before, will also help us become safer because we'll be able to see better at night. So it's a win-win-win situation in terms of controlling this, and I do feel hopeful that we can get it done.
Paul Bogard, he's a teacher at James Madison University in Virginia. His book is called The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Joined us from KGNU, radio station in Boulder, Colorado. Paul Bogard, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you for having me.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Our thanks to Walker Adams. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.